Enjoying your lunch. Thanks very much for joining us today. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm with Reuters here in Hong Kong. Before we get started, just a few brief housekeeping notes. First of all, the cell phone warning. Please, if you wouldn't mind switching off or turning to buzz your cell phone so they don't ring during this session, that would be great. And also, just to let you know about our next luncheon speaker coming at the FCC. It'll be happening next week on the 31st of May. We'll have Bruce Rockowitz, who's the CEO and group president for Li & Fung, coming to speak. He'll be talking about wage rises in China and the impact that it's having on his business and other businesses based in Hong Kong. It's my pleasure now to introduce the Honorable Bill English, who I'm sure most of you in the room are familiar with. He's on a whistle-stop tour through Hong Kong, and we're thrilled to have him here. As you know, Deputy Prime Minister, Finance Minister, and also Minister for Infrastructure, a very impressive portfolio during some very interesting times, the global financial crisis, recovery from that, and then the earthquake which struck late last year. So if you'd like to join us, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for that, for the introduction, and thank you all for taking your time out because of your interest in New Zealand. This is, I think, 2 years since the last time I spoke at the Foreign Correspondents Club. And the reason, there's a couple of reasons that we come to Hong Kong, and on this trip I've been in Singapore for a couple of days. One is to simply maintain the political contacts through the Asia-Pacific area and get the politicians' views. And I have the opportunity to meet the Prime Minister and Minister of Finance in Singapore, the Chief Executive for Administration this afternoon here in Hong Kong. We also speak to the central banks and particularly to investors, that is people who increasingly are buying New Zealand government debt and those who are starting to look for more opportunities in New Zealand and New Zealanders who are starting to understand the scope of the opportunities in the Asia Pacific. I'll just sketch for you briefly where New Zealand economy is up to and cover some of the issues of more topical interest, such as the earthquake in Christchurch, and then a bit about the future prospects that we see. I just delivered a budget the other day, and it's, I think, going to bring to a close a period where New Zealand, like most developed countries, has been very much internally focused on managing its recession. In our case, we've run up some fairly significant government deficits supporting household incomes through the recession. But because we're a country with relatively high external debt, we can't keep doing that. So we've been tightening up, and by 2014 we'll be one of only a couple of developed countries that actually have budget surpluses. But probably just as importantly along the way, we've been focusing on lifting our longer term economic performance and getting ourselves in shape to take advantage of the huge growth going on in the Asia Pacific area. Because if we want to lift incomes in New Zealand, then we will only be able to do that by hooking into economies that are growing significantly faster than ours and willing to pay more than has been historically the case for our goods. So we've embarked on a longer term program around infrastructure investment, roading and energy. This week we finalised arrangements for the rollout of 100 megabit ultra-fast broadband around the country, so within probably about 3 years, all businesses, all government services and most households will be on, have access to the ultra-fast broadband. And that seems to us pretty important in a smaller country, quite a challenge in New Zealand, a bit more difficult in New Zealand than it is in Hong Kong to achieve that, but it but it is going to be in place pretty soon. We've also gone through some quite significant tax reform to discourage people from the kind of excessive consumption and housing speculation that has crippled developed economies and has had a pretty negative impact on our economy. So we've raised our GST and used all the revenue from that and higher tax rates on property investment to cut taxes on income, on savings, on investment returns, and cut the company tax rate. So now about three quarters of New Zealand earners have a marginal tax rate of 17.5 cents. That's the highest tax rate that they pay. And our top tax rate is now significantly lower than Australia and the UK. In fact, one of the lowest top tax rates in a developed economy. And that's all been broadly accepted by the public. And we've also been focusing on making sure we get an investment environment that is more pro-business, makes it easier to create jobs, and helps us to be more competitive for people and capital, particularly with Australia, which, as you know, has had a pretty successful economy. Now, within the context of that long-term view, we've had some shorter-term events that are both public, both positive and negative. One has been the Christchurch earthquake. It is pretty large. In fact, we can't find a natural disaster in a developed country that is proportionately as large. It's two or three times the size of the impact of the Japanese tragedy, four or five times the size of the impact of Hurricane Katrina. It's going to cost us about 10% of GDP to rebuild that city. The good news is that it's very heavily insured, so almost all the houses and businesses are covered by insurance. So a significant proportion of the $15 to $20 billion that it will cost to rebuild Christchurch will come from offshore insurance markets. And the government is picking up significant cost, but we have pre-funded and expensed that cost in this last year's budget. So we've got the money to do the job. And now we just have the challenge of cutting through the tangle of building owners, insurance companies, banks, in fact multiple insurance companies, landlords, tenants. Don't have an earthquake. It is incredibly complicated as everyone works through their own commercial exposures, their own risks and their own legalities. And please read your insurance contracts. No one does, and they don't know what they mean until they have a disaster. And usually they don't mean what you thought they meant. So go and have a good look at them. We have learned a lot from disasters in other places like Kobe, the west coast of the US, and New Orleans. And the key learnings out of those are you need a very decisive, centrally driven process. Otherwise, the commercial interests and the local political interests can paralyse the recovery potentially for years. I would expect that by the end of this year, we'll see significant rebuilding in Christchurch and activity peaking in a couple of years' time. Some of these issues are quite complex. The largest building in Christchurch, the tallest one, is a Grand Chancellor Hotel at 37 or 38 stories. If you're looking for recycled hotel rooms, well, they'll be available. It's not structurally damaged that much, it's just that it's on a lean in the middle of the central business district, which you could see is somewhat threatening to the locals. And just yesterday we finalised the demolition plan, and it'll take a year to demolish that building, starting from the top. And that's one of 1,000 buildings, the biggest one, thank goodness, of 1,000 buildings that need to come down. But New Zealand is open for business. In fact, Christchurch is open for business. The biggest problem there at the moment is traffic jams. Two-thirds of the city is operating very well. One-third is, you know, significantly damaged. If you really want to help, you can, of course, donate to the Earthquake Fund. It's going to take us several years to get everything done. But probably more importantly, book some tickets. Come to New Zealand. We need all the wealthy tourists from Hong Kong that we can get, because for too many people in this region, the only pictures they've seen of New Zealand in the last few years have been the pictures of destruction in Christchurch. And some of them, particularly the Japanese, think New Zealand is shut down. It is not. We are doing fine, and we can handle the earthquake. The other more positive event that's coming up is the Rugby World Cup. Now, these events don't have that, in my view, their direct economic impact is overestimated. You can always find a consultant who will tell you that an international event or a new stadium will make you much richer. It's not true. We will lose money on the Rugby World Cup. New Zealand will. But it is going to be a big boost for confidence, and as the third biggest sporting event in the world, will put us on the world stage. Probably the biggest long-run economic impact of it will be the fact that the major international sponsors are bringing so many of their clients to New Zealand who would otherwise never come. And I'm thinking of sponsors like Visa or Steinlager or Adidas. And that gives us an excellent opportunity to showcase New Zealand. There'll be a few nerves along the way because of the strong focus on whether the All Blacks can win. And I almost had a heart attack yesterday morning. I was sitting in the studio for the Squawk Box program on CNBC in Singapore. And while I was sitting at the desk, the presenter said to me that, you know, said, I've just had in my earpiece some breaking news from New Zealand I should tell you about. I thought, oh gosh, this could be tricky. Who knows what's happened? Maybe I'm meant to be standing for the IMF job or something. And she said, yeah, the news is that the All Black captain has resigned. And I did feel a few pangs of anxiety there, because I knew they'd been negotiating with Richie McCaw and Dan Carter, the faces of rugby for the world to some extent. It turned out, I said to her, actually, I think he has re-signed. Which is actually the case. He has re-signed. And then she owned up to being an Australian. So it was a bit of a dirty trick. We have an election actually just 6 weeks past the final of the Rugby World Cup. We're telling anyone who's listening that the results for the All Blacks will not determine what happens in the election. The government can still win even if the All Blacks don't. But they are looking like they're in pretty good shape. So that is going to actually help springboard New Zealand into a more positive frame of mind as we get out of what's been a pretty long recessionary drag. New Zealand went into recession early 2008, and we're only really just getting out of flat growth over the next 6 months. So that'll be, you know, close on 4 years. But we are quite positive about the future, and that is largely to do with what's happening in the Asia Pacific region. Just some indications of the potential there. About 6 weeks ago, I was in China, where we get treated very well, I must say, even better than we do in Hong Kong. The Chinese have this rule of treating small countries the same as large countries. And ironically, it's easier for us to get access to the leadership of China than of the US. So I go there as, you know, a deputy leader from a small country, and had the opportunity to talk to both Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang, who will be most likely taking over the leadership next year. Both of them have been in New Zealand in the last 2 years. Myself and John Kiva, the chance to host them in New Zealand and then meet them again in China. And they do overdo it. in 5 or 6 days there, we never stopped at a traffic light, which would be a great idea in Hong Kong, if you could arrange that. And in fact, on the last day when we left from Shanghai out to the airport, the motorway was actually closed between the central business district and the airport. There were no cars on the motorway and queues of 2 or 3 kilometres by the on-ramps. So this is a place where they take politicians seriously, unlike New Zealand, where the Prime Minister gets criticised for getting chauffeured around in a BMW, which is a very cheap deal, I have to say. But what Chinese and New Zealand government have agreed is that we want to double our exports into China in the next 4 years. So they're currently 10 billion. That's 40% higher than just 2 years ago. And they want to see it hit 20 billion by 2015. So in a country where politicians matter, we've got political permission. What we have to do now is get the New Zealand effort very focused on how to take that opportunity, either directly into China, or perhaps, I think, in easier steps for New Zealand companies through Hong Kong, which is clearly a bit excited about being the centre for renminbi transactions. They must be exciting because even the head of the monetary authority, who we met this morning, was sounding excited about these technicalities of how the capital controls on the renminbi and the banking system interact. But it's all good news from our point of view. And of course, China's not the only growing market. Every market in the Asia Pacific is now growing pretty fast. And our fundamental advantage in those markets is our food production, based on the fact that we've got water. And that's, when you look at the Chinese drought situation, the problems Australia had up until it had massive floods, water's starting to matter. We have more per capita than anywhere except Iceland. But in Iceland, you've got to melt it down before you can use it, as comes in the liquid form. But that is the basis of our food production. And I've taken the opportunity on these trips to increase others' understanding of how New Zealand works. It's not all mountains and lakes. We actually do some business, and some reasonably sophisticated business. There's some opportunities which we haven't taken because we don't fully understand yet. Just watching the news in this region, doesn't matter which country you're in, the focus on food quality and food standards is pretty strong. We know that because a New Zealand national Chinese was recently prosecuted in Auckland because they were going into the supermarkets and buying all the infant formula, taking it home and then selling it into mainland China across the internet at exorbitant prices. So even paying New Zealand retail prices, they could compete because Chinese parents want to buy non-Chinese infant formula. We haven't yet worked out how to take the intellectual capital we built up over decades, over 100 years, around food quality and food processing and marketing, and turn it into real value across a region where consumers place a very high value on that. So the way we think of the New Zealand economy is we're hooked to the China-Australia train. We are fortunate to have as our biggest and third biggest trading partners the two fastest growing economies, the fastest growing developed economy and the fastest growing emerging market economy. If it comes off the rails, well, we'll have a few problems. But even if that train slows down, it's still going to be going pretty fast. And we intend to get on the front foot and over the next few years take the opportunities that are being presented in a very positive way. So it's great to have the opportunity to come along and learn more about how that can happen through, in some small part, through Hong Kong, just to finish off with a little bit of local about how it works from the New Zealand point of view. One of our successful exports through Hong Kong is live lobster, which comes from my part of the country in New Zealand, which is right down the bottom So the lobster are caught in Fiordland, off the national park. These are very sustainable lobsters, crayfish, and the price for them is unbelievably high. And it's great to see a local industry that's where the fishermen a number of years ago shut the fishery down for quite, or reduced the catch sharply for quite a long time, took the financial hit while the fishery rebuilt and are now world-class farmers of that product and being rewarded with very high prices. And it all flows back to a little town called Te Anau with a population of 2,000. And they're doing very well courtesy of Hong Kong and China. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. We have 10 to 15 minutes for questions from the audience. There is a microphone, so if you have a question, please raise your hand and we'll bring it round to us and tell us your name and your organization if you're with one. Right over here.
Yeah, hi, Darren Mitchell from Tauranga. Bill, a question for you. Obviously, the primary produce area is to do well from China. What other sectors of the New Zealand economy can we help promote New Zealand to do well as well?
Oh, I think there's a number of others. I've just talked about the food business because it's most, you know, obviously high-profile business. But I think you've got the areas where it's really starting to move. One is oil and gas. We've got one of the largest economic zones or ocean zones in the world, 200-mile limit, and we've because of the government promoting it pretty hard, we've now got a couple of large world-scale explorers, Petrobras from Brazil and Anadarko, coming to New Zealand with exploration programs are going to build up pretty healthily over the next 4 or 5 years. I think we've got a lot of other areas where, and I've just actually been speaking to a venture capital function before I came here, New Zealand venture capital operators coming up here just to get a very, very tiny slice of the billions that are sitting around in Hong Kong. What you'll find, as I think you know in New Zealand, small niches of amazing things where a handful of scientists or a couple of businesses have, for almost accidental reasons, got some product or service that's world-beating. And often their main constraint is actually finding access to capital. So we've got a lot of quite clever ideas, and we're getting, I think, much better at turning those into business propositions. And you just can't predict what they are. They can be an IT. You know, the Lord of the Rings was just one nutty guy that's turned into a franchise across the whole developed world and spawned a whole industry, not just in Wellington, but elsewhere. Who would have known that? I mean, he was a loser who made splatter movies, wore shorts and a beard and bare feet. You wouldn't have picked it. Well, I didn't. Perhaps someone else did. And so I think a lot of the development of our economy is about providing the environment where that kind of inventiveness can thrive, alongside fishing, forestry, a booming dairy business, and so on. But if you've got any we don't know about, let us know.
Questions? Over here.
Hi, Mr. English. This is Sophie. I'm the reporter from Bloomberg. I just have a question. Today, we saw a report saying the China Investment Corp has set aside $6 billion New Zealand dollar to buy New Zealand government bonds and other assets. Is that true? And what do you think? Do you welcome such, you know, investment plan from China?
I've seen the report just actually before it came in the door, so I don't know whether it's true or not. It came from a journalist, so you've got to be a bit careful. who reported sources who said we were speaking to the Chinese Investment Corporation just 6 or so weeks ago, and to SAFE, who have got $3 trillion of foreign exchange reserves. If you look at their 5-year plan, the Chinese government is, you would sum it up by saying go global. So their outward investment 5 or 6 years ago was almost zero. Now they've got these massive piles of cash, and like everyone else, they're trying to diversify a bit from holding US government debt. So I wouldn't be surprised if they've allocated a tiny sliver to New Zealand and a slightly larger sliver to Australia. We haven't had any discussions with them about that or what. What did impress me over there was that the larger investors and the government-related investors understand the need to be able to demonstrate mutual benefit in the countries in which they plan to invest. They don't want to be seen as profiteering or plundering in the way that perhaps they've been characterised in places like Africa. I think they realise if they don't want political opposition to that investment, which is easily inflamed in most of the developed world, then they need to tread pretty carefully. And I was impressed with the frankness and the understanding of the decision makers over there about that. And New Zealand wouldn't be a great exception. We've had a couple of significant investments lately. New Hope, which I discovered is a very large company in China, just bought a processing plant and a milk processing plant in Canterbury. And I'd expect that as the trade flows develop, the investment is going to follow. I think New Zealanders probably need to understand that. That's historically been the case. We do a lot of trade with Australia. We have a lot of Australian investment. We used to do an enormous amount of trade with the UK. The UK had significant investments in New Zealand, much less now. So I'm sure if the CIC think we need to know about it, they'll let us know.
Francis, I know you had a question.
Francis Moriarty, RTHK. I'm just wondering, you mentioned powdered milk, which is a very sensitive subject here. You may not know that we have scenes of people coming here to buy powdered milk to take back to China as well. But my understanding is that it was actually New Zealand that blew the whistle, or a New Zealand company, but through diplomatic associates, that blew the whistle on the milk powder scandal. And I'm wondering whether there was any price to pay for that, and whether some of these dealings now are trying to get things back on track as a result of that.
It was Fonterra that initially blew the whistle about, you know, people down the supply chain. It was nothing to do with the New Zealand company, but they became aware of the milk doping, basically. That was cleared up pretty quickly. So the New Zealand company had to write off all their capital. They had investment in a Chinese company that collapsed because of the scandal. But I think the Chinese government have a very good understanding of what Fonterra's role in that was. It was all cleared up pretty quickly, and they're going flat out again in China with very fast growing revenues there. So it's probably in a way turned out to be a positive in the longer run because of the integrity with which they acted. Even though in the short term they wrote off $200 million.
I'd like to just slip a quick question. And you talk about the increased trade and ties with China, but there's also talk globally about concern about land grabbing, buying up large tracts of land in places like Australia and New Zealand. At what level of Chinese investment in particular would you start to get concerned?
I think there's general acceptance. There would be general acceptance of Chinese investment in most respects. I mean, our hotels are all owned by Singaporeans. A lot of our commercial property has got ownership from Hong Kong, increasingly from China. But there is sensitivity in New Zealand about farmland, and we have a set of guidelines to overseas investors that are designed to limit the aggregation by large-scale investors of farmland and limit the vertical integration between owning the land plus the processor. Those haven't, they're new, they were put in last year and they've yet to be tested. They also encourage anyone coming in to buy farmland, essentially encourage them into joint venture arrangements. They always use, I mean, corporate purchase of New Zealand farmland is as old as the hills, and I can tell you from my experience as in a farming community and as a farmer, it doesn't work. In the long run, they always get sick of low returns and sell it back to the locals and disappear. And if the Chinese come, there'll be no exception. But you know, anyone coming in needs to be sensitive to it, because if it becomes excessive, it'll just get shut down.
We have time for two more questions. We'll take one here and then over there.
Robin Fox, I'm an associate. I believe I'm correct in saying that last year the New Zealand government significantly revised its financial regulation. In particular, it allowed financial service providers, registered companies, which could take deposits with minimum capital. I mean, that flies in the face of the policy of most other governments in developed countries to restrict the growth of the development of new financial institutions, one that take deposits. Can you say something about the rationale behind that? What's the government in New Zealand looking to achieve by?
So you were saying we were allowing non-banks to take deposits?
The creation of non-bank deposit-taking companies.
Oh, okay.
Quite low. I mean, maybe that's not your area, but.
Yeah. Look, by the end of this year, we will have completely re-regulated our financial sector. And it's almost the opposite of how you're characterising it. The main weakness in our financial sector was non-bank deposit takers. And there was a range of activity from fraud through to gross irresponsibility and a lot of money lost, while our banks were largely untouched. So the new regulation essentially puts the non-bank deposit takers into a similar regime to the banks. And if anything, the concern is probably that we have effectively eliminated second tier financing, because the capital requirements now are much tougher than they were, and the activities are now supervised by the banking regulator, which in our case is the Reserve Bank, whereas they didn't used to be supervised at all. We have worked pretty hard. Taxpayers around the world now don't like financial service guarantees, financial sector guarantees, and by the end of this year there'll be no crown guarantee of any financial institution. So if they get in trouble from here, they're going to have to look after themselves better than they did last time.
One more question over here.
Hi, Warwick Simons from GovCal. Just a question regarding your ties with Australia. You mentioned that, you know, Australia is riding along behind China, and New Zealand will hopefully ride along on that train as well. What happens if Australia takes a stumble? And how much is New Zealand's economy independent enough from Australia so that the plans that you talked about, you know, having a budget surplus in 2014, et cetera, if Australia growth was to slow down, you know, how much would that affect New Zealand?
Well, it will affect us somewhat. We have the benefit of a fairly diversified export destinations. So I think Australia is about 15%, somewhere between 15 and 20% of our exports. And the principal benefit we're getting there is, if you think you've got to think of Australia as two tracks increasingly. In fact, it's becoming quite stark between a very pumped up resource sector and the rest of the economy is actually slowing down in the manner that New Zealand did 2 years ago. So they're not actually immune to gravity in the way they have been saying. Their consumers shutting up shop, their housing market's dropping off. So the effect that's had is it's driving up their exchange, the Aussie dollar. So we are now more competitive against the Australian dollar than we have been for 30 years. So it's a very good opportunity to attract Australian tourists in the first place, because we've got real snow. Their stuff's just painted on the pamphlets. And to compete to service the resources boom like a seventh state. And my view is we should be a lot more assertive about competing in the Australian market and a bit less mesmerised by the Lucky Country story. So they would have to have a pretty big slowdown for us to really suffer. But it's possible. I mean, it's iron ore and coal. The good that's very narrowly focused. The good news for them is you can only get iron ore from Brazil or Australia. And China's got to keep buying the stuff. They don't like it, but they will. So it keeps, yeah, look, it's a bit of a worry, but not a huge worry. Probably the bit that has worried us as much in the past has been the banks, because we've got the same banks. And the Australian housing market has looked out of kilter. They didn't believe that, but I think they do now. However, those banks are that among the top 10 safest banks in the world, and I think they will handle a housing slowdown quite adequately. So that's not too much of a risk. But yes, we are vulnerable. We've got the highest export prices in a generation. We're vulnerable to those if they drop a lot. But even if they come up 15 or 20%, which is quite likely, I don't think that will interfere too much with our with the momentum we're going to pick up over the next wee while. I mean, it's just a bit like China. I mean, if your trade is growing at 20 or 30% a year, then fluctuations in the price don't matter quite so much. And that is the big opportunity we've got.
We'll leave it on that note. Thank you very much for joining us.